This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.
This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. 25 years ago, militant leaders of the American Indian Movement occupied the Indian Reservation village of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, for 71 days. Only one reporter, Kevin McKiernan, was behind Indian lines for the entire occupation. In a moment, we'll talk to him about his experience. But before we do that, let's look back at this week's History in the News. The hot item in the news recently has been the long-rumored affair between Thomas Jefferson and his slave, Sally Hemings. First suggested in 1802 when Jefferson was president, the accusation, to which Jefferson never directly responded, was dismissed as politically motivated by most of Jefferson's contemporaries and nearly all historians since. Although not uncommon for slave masters to have intimate relations with their slaves, Sally Hemings herself was the product of such an affair, as was her mother. In the absence of any direct evidence, scholars denied the charge, relying on Jefferson's clearly stated opinions of African Americans as not only inferior to whites, but physically repugnant. Well, DNA tests appear to have proved them wrong, in that Jefferson did father at least one of Sally Hemings' children, her last, Easton Hemings. Turning to this week in history, on December 15, 1890, the great Sioux Indian chief Sitting Bull was shot by U.S. cavalry at Standing Rock, South Dakota. Plains Indians, provoked by hunger, disease, loss of reservation lands, and a string of broken promises by the U.S. government, had resorted to the Ghost Dance, a religious movement that promised the disappearance of the white man and the return of the Indian world in which they once thrived. White settlers saw the Ghost Dance as a prelude to war. The U.S. cavalry moved in, Sitting Bull was killed, and a group of over 300 Sioux fled, only to be cornered and massacred 13 days later on the banks of the Wounded Knee River. You're listening to Talking History.
One or two people in Little Bighorn Bunker have been hit. It's impossible to get a medic out because the firing is so heavy.
The Wounded Knee apparently has a wounded party. Stated to us that they were going to send medics in, and the man that went to that bunker was carrying a rifle. We will not recognize a medic carrying a rifle.
The Sounds of Wounded Knee, 1973, from the inside. Recorded by today's guest, Kevin McKiernan. I mentioned earlier the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890, a symbol of the injustices perpetrated against Native Americans. In 1973, 200 heavily armed members of the American Indian Movement again occupied the village of Wounded Knee, now on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, in another attempt to rectify abuses at the hands of the federal government. Kevin McKiernan was the only reporter allowed to remain in the compound during the entire 71-day siege. Drawing on that experience, McKiernan later produced the documentary In the Spirit of Crazy Horse that aired on PBS in 1990. Thank you, Kevin, for joining us.
Thank you.
How did you end up being the only reporter behind the lines at Wounded Knee?
Well, I was not the only reporter at Wounded Knee itself. There were hundreds of reporters over the 10-week period, the 71-day period. But early in the occupation, the village was closed by the government, and there was a news blackout, and I sneaked in the back door. And Wounded Knee stretched out day after day. Many people thought it would be a weekend confrontation, and I certainly had no idea when I left my home in Minneapolis-St. Paul and drove some 600 miles, I guess it was, out to Wounded Knee that I would be gone for more than that time. So during that last 7 weeks or so, when most of the firefights took place when two Indians were killed and many others were wounded, when a baby was born, when a marriage took place. In fact, I was the only reporter inside.
It's interesting. It seemed life was going on behind the scenes during the whole siege.
There was. It was the cycle of life from birth to death, and it was certainly an education for me as an outsider. I was somewhat of a stranger in a strange land, and I learned a lot of things that in the 25 years since have remained, many of them, in my mind.
And once the occupation began, you were pretty much locked in. Could you have gotten out or walked away if you wanted to?
Well, Wounded Knee was surrounded by several hundred FBI agents, federal marshals, border patrol agents, BIA agents, and so egress and ingress were difficult. In fact, when I had come in, I would have been arrested, as many others had been arrested had I been caught. And it was very much of a Stalag 17 look, with searchlights and Vietnam-era phosphorant flares in the air at night and so forth. So it was difficult, and it was difficult for us inside to receive basic supplies like food during that time period.
Well, what brought about the occupation? What was it all about?
Well, as you indicated in your introduction, you can trace this history back to the 19th century and to this period of the so-called Indian Wars from 1860 to 1890. Wounded Knee was a symbol, and it was a symbol like My Lai was a symbol in the Vietnam War, a symbol of a very tragic massacre. In the 20th century, American Indians were victims of a policy called termination, and termination was a federal effort to get Indians off the reservations and into the cities and to assimilate them. And of course, this is based on the melting pot theory in the United States, and to a great extent, termination failed. But those Indians who did come to the cities, cities like Minneapolis and Cleveland and Rapid City and Omaha and so forth, found themselves very much at the margin of society. And out of that group of Indians, many of whom went to prison for conflict with society, the American Indian Movement was born. It started in 1969. And those who founded it really founded it many years before in prison, in Stillwater State Prison in Minnesota, mostly Chippewa Ojibwe Indians. And they found that they were experiencing the same stories. They had ended up in the same place for the same reason. Their language, their religion, their way of life had been proscribed. And so I think AIM really came out of that experience.
Now, AIM represented, however, just one group, because the Native Americans were divided at Wounded Knee, at least my understanding, or maybe if not on that particular reservation at large, there was a division in the Indian movement.
The division on Pine Ridge itself was a division, a very old division, between traditional and non-traditional Indians. And the American Indian Movement, which was a very militant, city-based group, joined with a rural group, with those traditional Indians on the reservation, and they were in conflict with the group which was more associated with the tribal council structure, the, if you will, the more assimilated Indians.
Now, the American Indian Movement got started in 1969. Perhaps their first major event was Alcatraz, the occupation of Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. There, the issues were fairly clear and specific. What were the specific goals for Wounded Knee?
Well, Wounded Knee was centered around a demand that the BIA be investigated, that the alleged corruption in tribal government at Pine Ridge be investigated, and also the 1868 treaty, which Wounded Knee was more or less in the center of, perhaps the most important treaty in American Indian history.
What exactly was in that treaty that they were interested in bringing up again?
Well, the 1868 treaty was a treaty that the famous Oglala Sioux warrior Red Cloud had finally signed after the U.S. had pretty much sued for peace because of the Bozeman Trail, because of the Powder Valley transgress that that the United States wanted. I think John Creighton, am I correct, the namesake for Creighton University, was one of the gold miners, was he not, mm-hmm. who needed to get up to the Montana gold fields.
Right.
And this was a major objective of the United States in bringing about and in asking the Sioux for the 1868 treaty. Now, the 1868 treaty said that the Black Hills in South Dakota were so sacred that no white man could cross them any longer. And when General Custer led a gold expedition there in 1874, the treaty was broken. And thereafter, one thing led to another, and really brought about the end of the Indian way of life, of hunting, and the move toward the reservations and so forth. So the 1868 treaty and the Black Hills were in effect, still in effect, despite the fact that Congress had abrogated that treaty in 1877. And so this was one of the central demands. But Wounded Knee was a larger and really a non-treaty issue in the sense that it was a platform for many Indian grievances all across the country and for dozens of tribes whose members were represented there.
And were they successful in achieving any redress for this?
Well, there was a White House treaty investigation afterwards that was ordered, but I really think that went nowhere. The effort to get a treaty commission, which was a central grievance at Wounded Knee, didn't go anywhere. During the course of Wounded Knee, then Senator James Aberesk from South Dakota was able to push through a bill during the actual time of the occupation that resulted in some 30,000 Indian jobs being created. So there were some tangible effects at the time, but I think it was really a consciousness raising, a nonspecific, intangible objective that Indians were after. A redress of grievances, a sense of pride, a sense of being, a soapbox, if you will, to air these grievances to the world.
What remains the memory that comes to mind immediately when you think about your time behind the lines at Wounded Knee?
Well, I think that I almost got killed a couple of times because of all the firepower that was directed at Wounded Knee. Then Attorney General Richard Kleindienst, who was Nixon's Attorney General, later testified in court that the federal government had fired some 500,000 bullets into Wounded Knee. So there was a lot of that kind of thing, but I don't think that's my central memory. I think my central memory is one of a point of view of, instead of covering the occupation from the outside, of seeing it from the inside, and for the first time in my life, being a minority, a white person in a sea of red faces, and for a chance to see things from a different perspective.
Did you ever feel you were in danger by being in the minority there while the siege was going on from the Native Americans?
Well, at first, I think the introduction might have been a little bit rocky because there was a lot of suspicion. Federal informers were there. People had come in and paraded as electrical inspectors. Postal inspectors had been kidnapped and held hostage at Wounded Knee. And there was a lot of venting of hatred, in some cases a reverse discrimination. But after a while, I don't think it made any difference because we were all experiencing the same kind of deprivation, if you will. In some ways, it may have been a good deprivation. I lost 25 pounds, and I probably could stand to do that again. But so those are some of my memories. And also, I think my memory is the revival of Indian religion and Indian customs and so forth. The most common thing that people would say in those days was, and really it's since also, I never felt as free as I did in Wounded Knee. So in a way, that 10-week experience was a kind of laboratory, if you will, to revive even, you mentioned earlier, the ghost dance, the sun dance, the sweat lodge. Many Indian religion had been outlawed, as you know, mm-hmm. and in fact it wasn't until a few years after the 1973 occupation that the Congress passed the Freedom of Indian Religion Act. That wasn't until 1978. So those kinds of things come to memory when I think of Wounded Knee.
Now, you followed the events after the occupation was lifted, the trials, and what really seems to be a almost an attack on the American Indian movement by the U.S. government. What can you say about that? What do you think happened to the movement? What about the reaction of the U.S.? Was it appropriate and so on?
Well, the government certainly over-indicted people after Wounded Knee, and they certainly overreacted to Wounded Knee. Most of the trials, the major trials, were thrown out because of the secret use of the U.S. Army at Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee was the largest and longest civil disobedience in American history at 10 weeks, but it also was the only time that the U.S. Army had ever been used within the U.S. borders, had been deployed and put into action. And this was a violation of the Posse Comitatus statute, and the federal court threw out the major leadership Wounded Knee trials as a result of that.
And the American Indian Movement itself, I mean, this, it started, as we said, in, well, 68 in Minnesota, 69 mm-hmm. was a big event at Alcatraz. Wounded Knee seemed to be the peak of the movement. We haven't heard much from it since.
The movement was never a card-carrying, meeting-oriented movement. I think AIM was more of an idea, and I think those ideas were taken back by those who had, to their particular tribes all over the country, by those who had participated at Wounded Knee. But AIM, as you say, was really on the ropes after Wounded Knee, with indictments and with informers and with jail terms and so forth. So by 1976, AIM had disappeared in some ways, at least from the headlines, but the American Indian Movement started survival schools, and these schools in communities like Minneapolis and Milwaukee still exist. Mm-hmm. And they, I think, tried to put into practice many of the ideas that had been born during that era.
Now, you returned to Wounded Knee for the 25th anniversary, so I can ask you, what happened at the anniversary? What are the memories of Wounded Knee on the reservation, though?
Well, many of the people who were alive in 1973 were not alive this year when I returned, but many were, and they came from different parts of the country. It was a terribly cold, particularly cold February, this 1998 anniversary. And so there was a gathering at the mass grave where in 1890 several hundred Indians had been killed, and prayers were given there. There were powwows, there were slideshows. It had some of the feeling of a high school reunion in a way, and yet I think people had a chance to take stock and to see some of the things that had changed, especially the attitudes, especially the fact that the Bureau of Indian Affairs to some extent had been reformed. You look around today on Indian reservations and you see casinos, you see Indians in control of their resources, and you see a lot of changes that didn't exist 25 years ago.
We only have about a minute left. You want to tell us a little bit about In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, what that is about? And
well, The Spirit of Crazy Horse is a film that PBS Frontline aired, and a film that fortunately has been aired in a dozen or so foreign countries. It came out of the experience of shooting 16-millimeter film. It's a video, but it includes that original film from Wounded Knee. It's really the story of a spiritual renaissance within in the Indian community, and one that began during the Wounded Knee era, and one that spread far beyond the American Indian Movement and far beyond that time period.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on a documentary about the civil war in Turkey between the Turkish government and the Kurdish minority.
Okay. Look forward to seeing that. And thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Kevin McKiernan, freelance reporter, who was at the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee and who produced the documentary The Spirit of Crazy Horse. You're listening to Talking History. John Dahl of the Society of Jesus is an internationally known photographer whose work has been featured in National Geographic and several Day of the Life books. He's also worked extensively with the Plains Indians of North America, having been assigned to the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota in the early 1960s. In 1997, for his photographic work among Native Americans, Dahl was given the prestigious Kodak Crystal Eagle Award for Impact in Photojournalism at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Don Dahl now teaches at Creighton University, and we've asked him to give us his view of Native American pride and culture since the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973.
Over the 30 years I've been associated with the Lakota, I've witnessed a tremendous growth in the numbers of people going to ceremonies, such as the Sweat Lodge, praying on the hill, and doing the sun dance. Many Native Americans give much credit to Russell Means during the Wounded Knee takeover in the early 70s for beginning the revival of the practice of traditional religion. Actually, the traditional religion never really disappeared. People often practiced back in the hills. They just didn't say much about it because there was, many of the ministers would say, you're doing magic, you're doing devil's work. And that has really changed in the last 30 years. In fact, many of the traditional, the Catholics, the Episcopals, the Lutherans, there's great respect now in the last 20 years for people who do practice traditional religions. In fact, I think I've noticed on the reservation there's a great emphasis, there's almost a great peer pressure to practice the Native religion. Although there seems to be a great continuum between people who do the traditional religion and then other people on the other end who say, well, no, I really don't need that. I love being a Catholic. I love being Episcopal. I love being a Lutheran. That's enough for me. Then, of course, there's many people in the middle who do both seamlessly. And there's been also a great rise in the number of sun dances done on each of the reservations that I'm acquainted with, and that's the Rosebud Reservation and also on Pine Ridge. I'd say it's a matter of great pride for a family, the extended family, the Teoshpa'e, to sponsor, to host a sun dance. I'd say there'd be almost 20 of them, and some families have their own weekend reserved in July, like a third weekend of July. Also, you'll see behind many of the homes on Rosebud and Pine Ridge, you'll see a sweat lodge. And I've been invited to many of the sweat lodge ceremonies, especially by my friend Albert Whitehat and Dwayne Hollowhorn Bear. Albert will say, do you want to sweat tonight? And they'll have a bonfire going over a stack of rocks. And the number is significant, how many rocks that you use in your sweat lodge ceremony that night. But it really is a prayer service, and Catholics and traditionals, religion people can understand that very easily, because you go around the room and you pray for what's important to you in your life. And this has been a wonderful thing for many young men and women in enabling them to establish contact, be proud of themselves as Indians, and get in touch with some of the problems that are in their lives and overcome some of the problems in their lives. So I know many young men and women who have put aside drugs, alcohol, drinking, and are proud of who they are now.
You've been listening to Don Dahl. His most recent collection of photographs, Vision Quest, Men, Women, and Sacred Sites of the Sioux Nation, is available in print form from Crown Publishers and interactive CD-ROM from Magus Productions. Welcome back. For our site of the week, we've chosen a relatively new museum that has already gained a reputation for its impressive collection of items from the culture of Native Americans of the Pacific Northwest. Here to tell you about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located 2 hours northeast of Portland, Oregon, is one of the most impressive Native museums, the Museum at Warm Springs. The intimate, excellently designed museum showcases the past and present of three tribes, the Wasco, Warm Springs, and Paiute, that share the 600,000-acre Warm Springs Indian Reservation. The tour starts with a video on the history of the people and the land, from salmon fishing to traditional wedding ceremonies to the impact of white settlement. You can see traditional dwellings inside, including plank houses and teepees, along with traditional music and stories. Children can enjoy the video of a traditional hoop dance. Plastic hoops are provided for the children to practice with as they watch. The museum is open daily, and there is a resort on the reservation complete with hot springs and golf.
Thank you, Cindy. And turning to our coming attractions, we have a rather unique opportunity to pass along to you, a chance to view the work of historical con artists. History lovers have long been the prey of street-side tricksters who peddle anything from supposed pieces of wood from the cross of Jesus to original copies of letters from George Washington. Massachusetts Concord Museum is now highlighting the products of this less-than-noble profession in an exhibit titled Fakes, Frauds, or Mistaken Identities. To make it even more fun, the exhibit, which runs through January 3rd, includes legitimate items as well, challenging visitors to tell the real thing from the fakes. For more information, call the Concord, Massachusetts Museum. This is Brian LeBeau.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.